This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it is 877-217-5757. You may also reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. We later in the hour with J.R. Ball, the Executive Vice President of the Baton Rouge Business Report, about much on this show and in our community, including Les Miles staying at Tigertown, opting to stay for a substantial pay hike and a contract extension through the year 2019, when Les Miles will be 66 years old. And we will talk with JR about that. But we begin with Gene Lyons, the nationally syndicated columnist who's based in Houston, Arkansas, not far from Little Rock, where he has lived for the last 40 years. And, of course, Gene Lyons is the author of Fools for Scandal, How the Media Invented Whitewater, and The Hunting of the President, the 10-year campaign to destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. Much has happened since the Clintons left office as president and first lady in 2000, and in the last 12 years. We've had three elections, and Barack Obama, four elections now. Barack Obama's won two, and George Bush won two. Gene Lyons, what's going on in the great state of Arkansas right now?
Well, it's not raining. We're worried about next spring. I live in the country now. I have a bunch of animals to feed, and that's the big item on my horizon. Also, of course, general public is feverish with anticipation about this football coaching search, which interests me a little, but not to the point where I lose sleep over it. And the Republicans have taken over the state legislature, and for many, many years, as long as I've lived in Arkansas, the letters page of the local paper was full of extremely conservative, shall we put it, fulminations and imprecations, and the right wing made all the noise and lost all the elections. Well, now they've taken over the legislature for the first time since Reconstruction, and people are wondering what's next.
Well,
we still have a Democratic governor.
Phenomenon that is happening in Arkansas has happened in other southern states. In fact, Arkansas is the last southern state really to have a Democratic governor and a Democratic U.S. senator at the same time. And it appears that the state of Arkansas has become almost as red as Louisiana. And it's happened rather suddenly. In fact, it happened suddenly here. 10 years ago, the statewide offices were held almost exclusively by Democrats. Now they're all Republicans. What do you attribute the change to?
Well, I joke about the Arkansas time warp because whatever's going on in the country at large, the opposite is usually going on here. We're almost always 10, 15, 20 years behind the rest of the country in whatever trends are happening. It's basically here, anyway, it's basically the Obama presidency and the reaction to it on the part of an awful lot of voters have tipped the balance. The Republicans have been working very hard for the last 15 years in particular, I'd say, just pulling a number out of the air, to organize around the state. For the longest time, as in most of the South historically, they're really was no Republican Party out in the rural counties, so people might vote conservatively in the general elections, in presidential elections, but they didn't have any Republicans to vote for locally, because the whole of respectable political opinion was contained inside the Democratic Party. Now we've got partisan politics. For the longest, we just didn't have partisan politics. The state and its people haven't really changed. It's just the political system that's changed, I would say.
Mm-hmm. In Arkansas, the city of Little Rock went for President Obama, but the state went overwhelmingly for Governor Romney. Same scenario was true in Louisiana with Baton Rouge, New Orleans, and Shreveport going for the president, but yet Governor Romney winning with about 59% of the votes in Louisiana. There appears to be a rural-urban divide in American politics right now, and it's not only a southern phenomenon. We can look at states like New York and California, and the same thing is evident. What do you think of this?
It's nationwide. It is happening all over. And it wasn't just Little Rock itself that voted for Obama. It was the county in which Little Rock is located, which has a lot of suburban towns as well. It was about 55-45. It's hard to know rural county. The traditional conservatism of rural people is holding out everywhere. And another thing that seems to be happening, I mean, I've read about it a lot. I've read a little about it because I don't want to sound like an expert, but it does seem that the people are separating themselves from their, it seems that people are locating in places where other people agree with them politically. That does seem to be happening. And, neighborhoods are either Democratic neighborhoods or Republican neighborhoods. The only city I know really well anymore is Little Rock, and that's definitely happening there. I mean, you can point to parts of town where, and this wasn't true when I came here 40 years ago, but it's definitely true now. You can point to parts of town where a Republican hasn't got a chance of winning more than 25 or 30% of the vote, and you can point to other parts of town where the obverse is true. And I'm not really sure why people are doing that, but it seems they certainly are.
Well, is race the elephant in the room?
I think to some extent it is. I mean, after all, the same state that voted for Bill Clinton six times as governor and twice as president now has rejected Obama, and as far as their policies are concerned, they're not very different. Bill Clinton was a hometown guy and a traditional Arkansas Democrat who knew how to straddle every fence that we had and appear to be on everybody's side a lot of the time. But I don't like to go too far on, I mean, race has a lot to do with it. But I also think I think that if one of my favorite African Americans, if Charles Barkley were to run for president, I mean, it's silly to imagine Charles Barkley as president, but say he were as accomplished intellectually and academically and so forth as Obama, and Charles Barkley became president, I don't think there would be the same reaction. I think it's partly the Barack Hussein Obama business, by which I mean the very foreign-sounding name, which a lot of people have just never gotten over. And I also think, however, that I think that his being black or his being literally African/American, not just a person of color or whatever phrase you want to apply, I think that that's affected the way people receive these crazy rumors that sweep the country about him. If you'll recall, I mean, I spent a lot of time having fun with debunking, investigating all the mad Clinton conspiracy theories that were floating around and being pushed by people like Jerry Falwell through the 90s, that Clinton was a drug smuggler, that he murdered a bunch of people, that he, the whole Vince Foster conspiracy industry. Most people just sort of, I don't believe that. But when they hear the same things about a guy named Barack Hussein Obama, who's a very aloof-seeming fellow from Chicago, they seem to tend to believe more of him.
Well, it's a case in which the president has difficulty getting traction in the South, particularly with white voters, but his overall victory on November 6th is now resounding. The latest popular vote figures have the president over 65 million and Mitt Romney under $61 million. It's about a four and a half, actually more than 4.5 million votes between the two of them, 50.9% to 47.4%. There weren't many polls in the days leading up to the election, Gene, that had the president 3.5 points ahead of Romney, but yet that's how it finished. How do you explain it?
Well, I was following Nate Silver's 538 blog in the New York Times, and I was following this fellow, Sam Wong, who's a neuroscientist at neurophysicist at Princeton, who does this sort of stuff for a hobby. The people who take state polls and average them, rather than and don't focus so much on national polls. And if you look at what they had, the result wasn't so surprising. Although it could be that the growing thing you speak of, the growing majority nationally, which is over 4 million votes now, is it was 4.4 million now?
4.5 million, yeah.
Yeah, that was a bit of a surprise. It was not a surprise at all that Obama won the election. He was leading all along, and for all the talk about momentum, there was no indication that Romney was ever catching up in the states he needed to win the election. He was compiling large majorities in the so-called red states, the old Confederacy and what H.L. Mencken used to call the cow states.
Huh.
And I speak as a breeder of cows. I'm not sure. I'm just, if that's what the big square ones out west where you can drive for an hour without seeing anyone coming the other way. Those places, the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas. But turnout had a lot to do with it. And I think that, what was funny was, I think I really haven't looked at this. This is a hypothesis I'd like to check out at some point. I think the turnout was somewhat down in a lot of the red states where Romney was leading considerably because people were so certain he was going to win by a landslide. And there was great anxiety among Obama supporters that he wasn't going to win. Because the polls I'm talking about didn't make a lot of impact on people, except on people like me who do this for a living. I think there was great anxiety. And I also think that the fairly naked attempts to suppress minority votes in a number of states really galvanized the minority voters. When you see those pictures of people standing in line for hours in Florida and in Ohio, it's pretty amazing. I kind of cottoned onto this on election day. The local station, on the first day of early voting, the local CBS station did interviews at the polling places in downtown Little Rock with people who were standing in line to vote early for several hours. And the first guy they interviewed was a black man from an African-American, since we're making those distinctions, who'd come from Dallas. He'd driven up from Dallas to vote early. He was determined to get his vote in. And I thought, that's really amazing. His vote isn't going to matter. There's no possibility that Obama's going to landslide Arkansas. There's no chance whatsoever.
All right, hold tight. We'll be back with Gene Lyons. We'll take a one-minute pause on WRKF and return with Gene Lyons in 60 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest at this time is Gene Lyons, the nationally syndicated columnist who's based in Arkansas. He has lived for 40 years, native of New Jersey, and a PhD in English from the University of Virginia. And Gene Lyons is weighing in on the election of 2012. And as we hit the break, and I had to cut you short, you were talking about one person in particular, Gene, who went to great lengths to cast a ballot on November 6th.
Yeah, it was a guy they interviewed on the local TV station. It was a very well-educated, very well-educated, well-spoken black man who'd driven up from Dallas to vote early. And I thought, wow, I barely made it. I had to wait about 20 minutes at my polling place out here in the country. And since I live in the country, I knew half the people in there. And we were all chattering about this and that, mostly, you know, cows and the weather, which is mostly what people talk about where I live. And I barely made it for half an hour. There's no possibility in this world that I would even drive from here to Little Rock, which is a little less than an hour away, to vote, let alone from Dallas to Little Rock. So the guy was really motivated, and I remember saying to my wife at the time, you know what? It looks like the Obama voters are really motivated and going to turn out.
Well,
that's the only observation I had. I think that had something to do with the size of the vote, and the same would apply to younger voters and you know, to the people who felt that they had stake and who won the election. I think there was anxiety on the part of Obama's voters nationwide, and I think there was a certain amount of smugness in the states that Romney was winning, so that the turnout may have been affected by that. I mean, if you lived in Arkansas, and I'm sure in Louisiana, and you mistook the mood here for the national mood, which is really only all people have to go by is their friends and the people they know, you would think it's going to be a landslide, which many people, I got a million emails from readers when I wrote columns. I wrote a column saying I thought this could be the end of Nixon's Southern strategy, and I got a lot of furious emails from people who assured me that not only was Romney going to win by a landslide, but the people of my ilk were going to be run out of public life. So, I mean, I know that that feeling was strong among a lot of people. People felt Romney's going to win by a lot.
Well, Romney apparently thought he was going to win. He had only prepared one speech for election night, and that was a victory speech. His concession speech was quite short. It was eloquent, but it was
very good.
Yeah. Unexpected.
You know, the first time I found myself, you know, thinking, you know, he's not so bad. You know, he's pretty good. It became him. It was short to the point. It was real. You felt like he was talking to you from, I don't want to say from the heart, but that's the only phrase I can think of. You felt like he was talking from the heart, that he meant what he said, and he meant what he said, and he said what he meant. I never had that feeling about him at any other point in the race. I mean, I think he was probably the least talented politician nominated by a major party since maybe Michael Dukakis.
Who also was governor of Massachusetts. Perhaps,
right.
Yeah, maybe there's something to that. But
I was thinking of that last night when someone was talking about John Kerry for next governor, for next Democratic nominee. I thought, oh my goodness, please! We've had three Massachusetts governors now, and they're all stiffs.
Well, the president has gotten about 51% of the votes, so that gives him two elections in which he's above 50%, and the only presidents in the last century who have done that twice, gotten over 50% twice, are named Roosevelt, Eisenhower, Reagan, and Obama. Is Obama, is he more popular than we think, particularly here in the South?
I don't know. I don't think, particularly in the South.
No, I'm saying that the South may be skewed.
It's hard for me to say how deep this this sort of fear and loathing goes that you hear expressed so much. It really is. I mean, I don't, in going around and talking to people and going about my everyday life and in meeting with our friends and talking to people we know and going to the feed store and going to the grocery store, I don't sense that this tremendous anger and anxiety in the country that you'd think was there if you only went by what you hear on talk radio and you read in the letters column of the newspaper and you know. I don't really sense that it's there. So it could be that he is going to die. I'll tell you what, if the economy turns around as I believe it will. And if he ends up, presiding over a relatively prosperous second term with things looking up on the economic front, and this presumes no foreign policy disasters, which is always a big assumption, but he will end up being an extremely popular president, and it will be extremely difficult for the Republicans. The Republicans I see out there today to have a chance of winning the presidency in the foreseeable future.
How much does the current president owe to Bill Clinton as someone who campaigned ferociously and effectively for him in this election?
Well, I think quite a lot. I mean, as people kept calling Clinton the explainer-in-chief, it's not clear to me why it seems to be so difficult for people to explain the kinds of things Bill Clinton explains in a way that large numbers of people can understand. But it does seem to be so. He is sort of the national explainer, and he did, I think, help a lot in those swing states. It's just, when I said the Republicans, I had this thing in the back of my mind. It's so silly to predict American politics more than about 3 or 4 years out, if that, because you have no idea what's going to happen. Who would have thought that Bill Clinton, the guy that I used to appear on your show defending from these lunatic charges, as I say, of drug smuggling, of conspiring with the UN to steal your guns, all that silly
right.
business. Who would have thought that he would end up the most popular politician in America? Who would have thought that Hillary Clinton, who not the extreme right, but the mainstream media, I'm talking about Time Magazine, Newsweek, the New York Times and all, they had her signed, sealed, and delivered for indictment by Kenneth Starr. Who would think that she would end up being so... it doesn't surprise me that she's effective as Secretary of State. It does surprise me that that's universally acknowledged.
Right. Well, lastly, Gene, if Hillary Clinton were to get the Democratic nomination in 2016, would, let's say, Arkansas, would it come back into the Democratic fold, or is it too late?
You know what? That's a really interesting question. My wife and I were talking about that the other night. I just can't say. It would be a whole lot closer, let's put it that way. And it would depend on a lot of things that aren't in evidence yet. What will the state of the economy be and all that? But and it also would, of course, depend on who she was running against. But I don't see a whole lot of talent on the Republican side now, and I don't see any. There is at the edges inclination to sort of change this hard shell warlike stance of the Republican Party and this sort of anti-government fundamentalism. Unless they change that, I think almost any Democrat will be able to could win. And I think Hillary Clinton could win here.
Do you think she'll run?
I have no idea. I'm the last person in the world who would know. I mean, if it were me, I'm the age now that she is then. They barely get me to leave the house to go to dinner, go to dinner, go to a meeting every single night, travel all across the country. I mean, I wouldn't do it, but I'm not her.
Well, we always enjoy hearing from you, Gene Lyons, and glad you're still opining about the American scene. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we're joined now by J.R. Ball, the Executive Vice President of the Baton Rouge Business Report. Good morning to you, J.R.
Jim, good morning.
9 years now on the job at the Business Report, right?
Well, it's probably in this job. It's actually coming up on 14 years in February.
9 years as the guy calling the shots, kind of.
Yeah, that's probably it. It all blurs together, but yes.
Okay. So you have exceeded your time that you spent with Tiger Rag.
Yes. This is now the longest tenured gig in my career other than just being a general goofball, which has been a lifelong passion.
You did cover sports with zeal for many years as the editor and beat writer for Tiger Rag, and yesterday was a big day in Baton Rouge with Les Miles deciding to stay as head coach. Any surprise?
No. You know, I mean, people can go back and forth and debate whether this was simply a leverage move to wrestle some more money out of LSU. My understanding is, I know, you know, people don't necessarily want to accept it, was, you know, Joe did say, look, this was the money we were going to give you at the end of the season anyway. And it's not what he's getting at LSU, which I don't know the exact amount, but I do know it's not what he was offered at Arkansas. It's less than what he was offered at Arkansas. So, you know, if Les needs money to put his four kids through college, as he indicated yesterday, if he's worried about that, if $3.79 or $4.1 million doesn't get it done, then Arkansas would have paid more money. So at the end of the day, I just think he has a much, much, much better situation here in Baton Rouge, not only with the football program, but when you look at the age of his children, they effectively have grown up in Baton Rouge. This is their home. And so it's tough when you have kids of that age to start uprooting them, because at the salary levels that these guys get, you know, an extra $600,000 is not that big a deal.
Well, his first child of college age opted to go to the University of Texas. Our friend Richard Condon said that was a slight to LSU. What do you think about Smacker Miles going to Austin, Texas?
I don't have any issues with that at all. Look, I think I would tell my children one of the greatest things I did was go to out-of-state colleges. I mean, this, you sort of grow up and you learn how to live. I don't know that there's some rule that states that every employee at LSU must send their children to LSU. I mean, I don't know that it's – I don't view that as an indictment on the academics at LSU.
But the argument could be made that here's a man who's the highest-paid public official in the state of Louisiana who earns – over $4 million to coach at LSU, that LSU ought to be good enough for his kids. For example, Nick Saban's daughter goes to the University of Alabama.
Well, and that's fine. I mean, I'd look at it this way. Les is saying, look, I'm saving the taxpayers some money because my kid was smart, would have been on top, so I'm saving the state treasury some money, not having to cover her tops bill. But, you know, so I mean, how you I don't know. I just don't accept the notion that not attending LSU is an indictment on LSU. I mean, I don't know what the girl wants to major in, and one of the things we all sort of need to get over is that some schools do things better. Now, if she wanted to be a journalism major, I'd say, you know, she's sort of foolish for going to UT Austin rather than LSU. If she wanted to be an accountant, she should have gone to LSU. If she wanted to be an engineer, she should have gone to LSU or Texas A&M. I mean, I don't know what she wants to do, but this notion that, I mean, this is part of the things that's wrong with this state is that, heaven forbid, that somebody dare dream that somebody outside of the state can actually do something.
Well, the other aspect of this, JR, is that people are losing their jobs at LSU. People are leaving the campus for other universities as a result of the quandary over the budget. And yet, when it comes to football, there seems to be an unlimited budget.
Well, it's a budget that's generated within the athletic department, and so you know, there is not a single professor at LSU or a single student that's being denied anything by the money that's spent in the athletic department. In terms of, I mean, that's all self-generated income, unlike other athletic departments in the state of Louisiana and in many places in this country. LSU doesn't take taxpayer dollars in the athletic department. So, I mean, I guess one could argue that LSU should be the athletic department should be pumping more revenue into the academic side, but they're already one of the top schools in the country in terms of athletic dollars being redirected back towards academics. So I guess you could say they should give more, and you know, Les should be paid like a professor and only make, you know, whatever they make, $80,000 to $120,000, whatever they get. And we could make that argument, but I don't know that there's a single professor that's doing the kind of work where CBS is willing to pay over $1 billion to broadcast an archaeology lecture.
But the case could be made that no matter who the LSU coach is, the money's going to flow pretty freely for the athletic department. The athletic department even managed to pay its bills during the Jodine era when there were 8 losing seasons in 11 years on the football field. So how much does Les Miles bring to the table that another coach would not?
Well, I think there's lots of evidence out there that when you start to look at, when you have a winning football program, merchandise sales go up. There are some that says even general donations to the institution tend to increase. Now, if Les Miles wins 5 consecutive national championships, will that suddenly solve the fiscal crisis at LSU? No, it won't. Will it suddenly make a mediocre academic discipline suddenly great? No, it won't. I mean, I guess probably the biggest fallacy is that the athletic department and the academic side are all that particularly intertwined. I mean, let's call it what it is. I mean, that is a business entity that just happens to be operating on the LSU campus.
Mm-hmm. Well, should Les Miles be paid, let's say, in the same zone as Nick Saban?
Well, I mean, that to me is a free market situation. If Les Miles can get that kind of money here, you know, good for him. I mean, he's not that far from Nick Saban money. Now, I guess if you say you're going to be matched, I mean, they put these clauses in their contract where they have to be the second highest this or the first highest that. I mean, and you look at it that way. But, you know, if LSU thinks Les Miles is worth that money, then pay it to him. If not, and Les wants to leave and go hire somebody else. I mean, that's the free market. Look, the way college sports have gotten, these contracts are a joke. The only reason for a contract to exist is so that when you want to fire a coach, the coach knows how much money he or she's walking away with to suffer the indignity of being fired. Everything else, there's no exit clauses. If a coach wants to go to Arkansas or Notre Dame, you don't have to pay anything. I mean, these are one-way streets. It is a significant business. I mean, I don't know, is Tom Cruise worth $20 million a movie? It is if that's what somebody's willing to pay. Do I find it insulting that a movie star gets $20 million to make a movie? Yes, I do. But that's the world we live in, for better or for worse.
Well, Gene Chizik, who just got fired at Auburn, will be paid $208,334 a month for the next 36 months not to coach. That's the danger. That's the danger of these kinds of contracts, JR, that if things don't work out with Coach Miles, then LSU will really have to cough up some real money to put him on the sidelines.
And that's the danger with, you know, probably my biggest concern with athletic departments in general are these knee-jerk reactions. Auburn's a prime example. There were inordinate questions about Gene when he was hired. I mean, he was not a popular pick there. He stumbles into Cam Newton. They win a national title, and all of a sudden, they're like, oh, we got to make this guy coach for life. If you want a closer example, look what happened when Mike Archer was here.
All right, well, hold that thought, JR. We'll return after this one-minute pause with JR Ball of the Business Report. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.R. Ball, the Executive Vice President of the Baton Rouge Business Report, is with us, and we're talking about a few items, but a few more moments with J.R. about Les Miles. Leslie Edwin Miles, who turned 59 a few days ago on the 10th of November, is now one of the richest people in the state of Louisiana, the highest paid public official. He was before the Arkansas offer, and now he is going to get a substantial pay raise, and his contract will run through 2019 when he is 66 years old. And he's won 85 of 105 games at LSU. Now, you were remarking about Coach Archer when we hit the break, JR. What were you going to say about Mike Archer?
Yeah, well, quickly, I mean, that's where you get into the knee-jerk. And I say this, I like Mike, and we're still friendly. But, you know, he was a controversial hire to replace Bill Arnsberger. You know, they get out the gate with 2 winning seasons. There was all these concerns, oh, my God, he's going to be anointed to replace Joe Paterno at Penn State because he used to mow Joe Paterno's lawn as a kid. Or Nebraska wants him to replace Tom Osborne. So there was all this hue and cry to lock Mike Archer up for the contract for life. Well, then he throws up 2 losing seasons, and next thing you know, we're buying the guy out and telling him to leave, and in comes the Curly Holman era. So, you know, these knee-jerk reactions can be very, very costly for athletic departments. And if you're going to give these 7-year contracts, you better be sure that you've got the right guy, because, as you stated, it gets expensive when you're wrong.
Well, there are many coaches right now on the sidelines who are multimillionaires. Houston Nutt, Gene Chizik's about to be one for not coaching. Derek Dooley will receive $5 million. His assistants will receive $4 million not to coach at the University of Tennessee. And because of that, J.R., Jaree Longman of the New York Times reports that Tennessee is foregoing $18 million in contributions that it was to make to the university over the next 3 years for academic scholarships. So it does have a cost when these things don't work out. And Les Miles is the guy that LSU and athletic director Joe Oliva, they're banking on him to keep on winning. But you were there for the era between 89 and 99 when LSU had eight losing seasons. Sometimes the wheels come off the wagon for no particular reason. Can LSU realistically expect this kind of success for as far as the eye can see?
Well, history indicates that that won't happen. I mean, I'm not talking about LSU history. You just look at the history. I mean, did anybody see the University of Miami slipping from its dominant position? But it's sort of been also ran in the game today. Oklahoma's the same. Nebraska's the same. I mean, about the only programs that have really maintained it is like Alabama. Now, I know they had a few down years, but by and large, Alabama's always a player on the national scene. And there may be a handful of others, but history indicates you're going to ebb and flow, and so at some point LSU will go through a cycle where winning 10 games isn't sort of a birthright. To me, the real tragedy, and not tragedy, but the insult to all of this is the ones who are actually winning all these ball games get nothing other than their college scholarship. I mean, so while Les Miles is making millions of dollars, the athletes that are winning those games basically get nothing. And I understand the value of an education. It's priceless and all that. But when you look at the physical play of that LSU-Alabama game, which was one of the most physical ball games probably played in college football in the last 10 or 15 years, I'm telling you, those guys were crushing each other out there. You can't tell me just free tuition makes up for the punishment that those kids took out on that field that Saturday night. It's incredible. And they make nothing.
Well, other than board books and tuition, right? And a good summer job.
What's the total cost of taking a whole year at LSU, put in whatever you want to put in, and compare that to what the lowest paid assistant coach gets at LSU in football? Mm-hmm. Is it even close?
Well, and it's also what our friend George Eames used to say. It's somewhat of a plantation mentality. Almost 80% of the team is black. The coaching staff is overwhelmingly white. The fan base is overwhelmingly white. As I look at the front page of the Baton Rouge Advocate at the Les Miles press conference, all white men covering the Tigers, no blacks, no women. There is a case here where people are getting rich off the backs of these poor black kids.
Well, now, yes, but there's white kids out there as well, and those kids are being just as oppressed as the black kids. I mean, if you're saying they're being oppressed. So I tend not to want to go to the George Eames plant. I mean, if you want to take the plantation mentality from the standpoint of the workers get nothing while the elite make their money, okay, I'll accept that. But I don't accept this as a black-white issue because, quite frankly, there's the same issue that goes on in the sport of lacrosse, which is predominantly white athletes running around out there or gym. Now, I mean,
well, nobody's making millions of dollars off lacrosse.
No, but LSU's making money off of baseball, and there's a predominantly white kids. I'm just saying as a general rule, yes, have African-Americans are the majority of athletes in football and basketball, the two big money winners, are a majority of those athletes African-American? Yes, they are. But I don't think the reason why athletes are not getting paid is because they're black.
No, that's not the reason. But nonetheless, most of the LSU team is black. And
most of every team is probably black unless you're probably at an Ivy League school.
Well, that may be the case. And it puts into focus that most of these black kids are not coming from privileged neighborhoods, and yet they're making millions for white folks like Les Miles and other coaches throughout the country. And these guys are not out there on the field, as you say, risking their life and limb.
No. Now, the other side of the argument would be that these kids are getting the opportunity to get a college education that perhaps they may not otherwise be able to get, and they could leverage that. The other side would be, well, you know, these kids are going there. They know the situation that they're getting into. And basically, they all have dreams of making the NFL or the NBA, and this is the path with which they go there. I'm not saying I buy that completely, but I'm saying that would be – look, does anyone think that the Honey Badger had would have been accepted or been recruited strictly on his academics? I mean, no. These kids are getting an opportunity to come out of these neighborhoods and get into a college environment because of their athletic ability. Now, does that make up for everything else? I probably would suggest that it doesn't.
Well, you're the guy who a few years ago bravely went before a public forum and said the Baton Rouge Country Club ought to integrate. It's been about 5 years, JR. I don't think much has changed.
No, you know, I do know that that particular the Baton Rouge Country Club, you know, they're sort of in a tough situation now. I'm not here to defend them because I still take the position. Look, they're a private club. They can do what they want. At the end of the day, there's just such a symbolic nature to the Baton Rouge Country Club, sort of like Augusta National. It's a private club. They can let in who they want to let in. It just sort of becomes a symbolic thing. And so, but the challenge that they're running into now, because I do know that they have actively gone to try to find some African American members, but the challenge will be either, because of what the requirements are, you know, you take the whole political class out of the equation because they just don't, you know, that's just their rules, whether you're black or white. But, you know, people don't want to be the first one. You know, they want to say, yeah, I'll come in, but bring five or six other guys in at one time, and that just hasn't happened. So, you know, I still think that for symbolic reasons, it's important for that club to integrate. But I do respect their right as a private club to let in whoever they want to let in. I just think it's wrong on multiple levels.
Well, you have written about race in Baton Rouge and how it affects the quality of life. Our neighborhoods, every facet of our life, the churches, you name it, race is a factor, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it ends up being race here in Baton Rouge just because there's a big divide. You know, I'm beginning to think more and more it's the economic divide. And when you look at that, you know, Baton Rouge, East Baton Rouge Parish is like 17% impoverished. The city, the corporate Baton Rouge is 24% impoverished. A majority of the people in poverty happen to be African American, but the fact that my view is this, look, racism is going to exist everywhere. Bigotry is going to exist in every city and every hamlet of this country and probably even the world. My challenge with Baton Rouge is, we aren't serious about this incredible poverty problem that we have, and we continue to deny the fact that we have two Baton Rouges. You know, we have black Baton Rouge. It's north of Government or Florida. It tends to drift depending on where you're at on the highway. And then you have white Baton Rouge that runs to the south of those roads. And the two really don't mix with one another very well. And there's a number of reasons for it, but it just, you know, and we are just blinded by it. And I just suggest that makes us a lesser community in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, you have opined about that in your columns. And change is difficult. In some places it's more difficult than others. What happens if we don't change?
Well, at some point, look, I take this, and people say, oh, you're becoming a liberal. No, I said, no, I'm still a fiscal conservative. My issue tends to be with, let's make the most efficient use of the money that we're giving to government. And so, like, this state's spending about $9 billion a year on poverty. How's that working out? We're just mitigating the problem. We're not doing anything to actually solve the problem. And, you know, if you wanted to, you know, everybody says, don't give them a fish, teach them how to fish. Well, you know, so invest your tax dollars when teaching people how to fish and then let them go fish. Don't just sit there and say, well, go save your money and go get a fishing pole and learn how to fish. I mean, that's where if you're going to spend the money, fine. And so when you get into the situation like we're in a cycle now where whether you're talking about the city parish level, the state level, the federal level, there's just not enough money to make everybody happy anymore. I mean, that's the real issue that we're dealing with in this country is we don't have enough money to do both give tax cuts to the rich or to the poor or to the middle class, whoever. We can't tax cut and expand the budgets at the same time. So for the first time in probably 150, well, since the Depression, government's got to pick winners and losers when it's funding things. So I'm saying from a poverty issue, you know, it impacts the quality of jobs you can bring to a community. It impacts negatively the workforce. It impacts your crime rate. It impacts what's going on in your public schools. It is a drain on the budget. And you're basically just leaving a whole class of people behind. And anytime you just ignore an entire class of people, the whole is going to suffer. You're always dragged down by, you know, the cliche being the weakest link. Well, the impoverished are the weakest link of any community.
J.R. Ball, the Executive Vice President of the Baton Rouge Business Report. What did you make of Mayor Holden's third election as Mayor President?
He was helped out pretty effectively by, a bad campaign by Mike Walker. I think probably the biggest stunner or the biggest surprise to me was how well Kip Holden did in Southwest Baton Rouge and even in Mike Walker's own district, too. I mean, I think Kip won almost half the precincts in Mike Walker's own district. So that may have been my biggest surprise. The shock would have been if there would have been a runoff. We'll see what Kip has in store for his final term.
Were you stunned at all about President Obama winning East Baton Rouge Parish?
Well, he beat John McCain. I guess the thing that was interesting is that he won by a bigger number over Romney in East Baton Rouge than he did over McCain. And I think it speaks to the point that I think there is a demographic shift happening here. Our African-American population is increasing. I think some of the more hardcore right people are moving to Livingston or Ascension. They're moving to neighboring parishes, with the exception of the central area, which is still a pretty hardcore Republican area. But you have a lot of moderates. And when you were given the choice between a Romney or an Obama, with those moderate whites or moderate African-Americans and Latinos, they seemingly went pretty hard for Obama. The other thing is you got a big government population here, and they're going to tend to go to candidates who espouse government, the support of big government.
What about the governor right now? The latest poll that was conducted by Bernie Pinsonat shows some slippage in his popularity. Do you think that's attributed, if it's accurate, if that's attributable to the budget cuts and cuts to higher education and to health care and other fiscal maneuvers by the governor?
Yeah, well, let's just put aside for the moment whether you agree with what he's trying to do. I would say anybody who over the last couple of years tries to overhaul the public pension system, tries to make dramatic changes to the options available for public education or how we educate kids, or decides to say not only are we going to restructure higher education, but in particular we're going to deal with the flagship institution. And now you've got a guy who now is, they're talking about overhauling to some degree the tax code in this state. I think you do that, you're going to lose popularity, because change is a very difficult thing. And, of course, it doesn't help, too. Jindal, everybody, is he running for national office? Why aren't you here? And, there's all these other little nickel and dime things that go on. But, again, I'm not saying whether or not I agree with what he's doing, but anytime anybody takes on those kinds of issues, you're going to spend a lot of political capital. Compounding that is the manner with which Jindal is doing it. You're probably spending more capital on top of it.
J.R. Ball, do you have any prospects that you think the governor is looking at to be the president/chancellor of LSU?
No, I don't know. I'll be honest with you, I don't know who. I mean, I know everybody wants to talk about Stephen Morey. I actually don't think that's going to happen, to be perfectly honest with you. I do think there's a national search. While I acknowledge that board, which includes my boss, Ralph McAllister, is populated with Jindal appointees, it stuns me that everybody thinks that's a revelation. Any governor who gets a second term controls the LSU board. I mean, it's that way, just the way the appointments work. Why it's a big deal under Jindal as opposed to Blanco or Edwards or anyone else or Foster, it's sort of an amazing thing. The big difference is Jindal's actually, that board's flexing its muscles a little bit. But who they get, to be honest with you, I don't know. And I'm serious when I say this. I don't think the LSU board knows who they're going to do hire. But I will say this, I'd be stunned if it's Stephen Morey.
Well, considering that your former bosses, Ralph McAllister and Steve Myers, both had successful campaigns for mayor, J.R., in 2016, any chance you'll run?
Well, if you look at the if you look at what happened when Roth ran, and if you look at what happened when Steve Myers ran, you know, Roth was probably one of the best finance candidates that's ever run. I mean, he had over $750,000. Myers probably had about $75. So I've seen it from both spreads. And the bottom line is, no, you're not going to see me running, primarily because I can't afford the pay cut, number one. And then number two, when you do what I do for a living, you're mouthing off and shouting out opinions, you know, just as many people dislike you as claim to like you.
All right. Well, J.R. Ball, glad you're doing well at the Baton Rouge Business Report, where J.R.'s columns appear in every issue, and he is the executive vice president. Thank you, J.R.
Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Take care. And that'll do it for today. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.